Good afternoon, Your Honors. Counsel. In 2002, the Board of Immigration Appeals ruled that Teles Foro Gutierrez was eligible for a Section 212C waiver. The Section 212C waiver is a discretionary waiver of removal that was available to immigrants with substantial ties to the United States. In Mr. Gutierrez's case, he's lived in the United States for 26 years. He has a United States citizen daughter, two United States citizen children, actually, and a United States citizen wife. Now, though the board held that Mr. Gutierrez was eligible for a Section 212C waiver, his lawyer failed to file the correct application form, and as a result, he was ordered removed. If it weren't for his attorney's error, it's important to stress that Mr. Gutierrez would have had a hearing. Instead, the Board of Immigration Appeals changed its mind after Mr. Gutierrez appealed and ruled that he was not eligible for the waiver. I'd also like to note that it's come to our attention that within the last couple of months, Mr. Gutierrez's former attorney has been ordered disciplined by the Attorney Registration and Disciplinary Commission. Now, the Board of Immigration Appeals has changed its mind because it's decided that persons who are deportable for a sexual abuse of a minor conviction are ineligible because there's no comparable ground of inadmissibility to the sexual abuse of a minor ground of deportability. Mr. Gutierrez has appealed to this court, arguing that this shift violates the law of the case, has an impermissibly retroactive effect on him, and violates his right to equal protection. He's also arguing that the board abused its discretion in denying his motion to file a late brief.
Could I stop you for a moment? Is your equal protection challenge a facial challenge to Section 1212.3F or an as-applied challenge? In other words, we seemed to say in Valera that there is no equal protection problem because that regulation ensured that deportable aliens were being treated the same as inadmissible aliens. Is that not happening in practice?
I'm sorry, is what not happening?
Is that not happening?
Yes, Judge. We're raising a challenge to the regulation, or at least the comparability test, as it's being applied to people like Mr. Gutierrez, who are essentially ineligible for the 212C waiver based on this, after having committed the same conduct as somebody who might have taken a trip to across the border, yeah, come back, and then been found inadmissible based on having committed a crime involving moral turpitude. I don't think there's any dispute that Mr. Gutierrez's conviction would be considered to be a crime involving moral turpitude. But it's also important to remember that our case is distinguishable from Valera because in Valera, the board had not held that the respondent had been eligible for the Section 212C waiver. In Mr. Gutierrez's case, the board actually held as much in 2002. And it's our position that this violates the law of the case. The law of the case doctrine is a doctrine that once an appellate body has decided an issue, that decision is binding throughout the litigation, except in the case of certain very narrow exceptions.
Let me just make sure you understood my question, because I'm not sure that everyone understands Valera. I'm not even sure this has to be that much different from Valera to get where you're trying to get. Do you understand?
I think so, Judge. My understanding of Valera is that it was premised on the fact that the petitioner in that case had not raised any challenge to, or had not submitted that there was any comparable ground of removability that would have been applicable, whereas in our case we contend that Mr. Gutierrez would have been inadmissible for a crime involving moral turpitude, and that but for the fact that he was apprehended in the United States as opposed to in Mexico, or on return from a vacation to Mexico, he would be similarly situated. Thank you, Judge. Again, with respect to the law of the case doctrine, the board stated in Mr. Gutierrez's case that he actually was eligible for the Section 212C waiver in 2002. And on remand, his attorney told the immigration judge that he actually didn't really understand what that meant. And the judge replied to Mr. Gutierrez's attorney that there was no ambiguity whatsoever in the decision. It meant that Mr. Gutierrez was eligible for a hearing on his Section 212C waiver application. If it weren't for his attorney's mistakes, Mr. Gutierrez would have had his hearing, and he relied on that, continuing to reside in the United States, work, and raise a family while he appealed. Moreover, he spent $10,000 of his very scarce resources to obtain that ruling. So this is really what the law of the case doctrine is all about. It's about preserving finality in cases where people rely on decisions of an appellate court. As I mentioned, there are exceptions to the doctrine, but none of them apply here. The government contends that the contrary decision of a higher court exception applies, and it contends that this exception should be understood in this case to encompass any change of the law, and that the Blake case was just such a change in the law. Later in its brief, however, when the government is responding to our retroactivity argument, the government claims that the test adopted by the board in Blake is actually a long-standing and well-settled one. So the government can't have it both ways in this case. And the government has cited no case, and we've found none, where the law of the case doctrine exception for a change in the law has been applied, except in the case of a statutory change or an intervening higher court decision.
Mr. Murray, before we address that, do you want to spend a moment or two on why it was an abuse of discretion on the filing of the late brief?
Certainly, Your Honor. In its decision on Mr. Gutierrez's motion, which I would note that he filed just 2 days after it was due, after having only just retained an attorney, the board simply stated that it found that Mr. Gutierrez's reasons were insufficient. Now, this court has repeatedly held that the board must give some kind of meaningful basis for its decisions, even when it's a discretionary decision. And this court, for instance, has reversed the board in cases involving motions to reopen, where the board just says it's not going to do it. It's reversed the agency where the immigration judge has denied a continuance without giving any reason whatsoever. In this case, there's no indication that the board took into account Mr. Gutierrez's pro se status because his attorney had rendered him ineffective assistance of counsel, his lack of resources, his lack of education, or any of the factors that he cited, including his own due diligence once he did obtain an attorney. So we would submit that the board's mere conclusory statement was insufficient to comply with this court's pronouncements.
They had before it, though, his motion, did they not, which outlined his reasons?
Yes, Judge, but their decision was a mere sentence, I believe, long, and it does not provide any indication that they considered his affidavit or any of the attachments to his motion, which was quite, as you'll see from the record, it was quite comprehensive.
So you think we should remand for that? Find out. I mean, you know, if we've done that in the past when there's an insufficient reasons presented, as you pointed out.
I think at this point, this court, we're asking that this court issue a decision on our law of the case argument, our retroactivity argument.
I understand it, but there's some deference to the agency too. If there's a ground for supporting their decision, but it's just not been found, for us to go to the merits without addressing this argument. I mean, we have a situation here of somebody who can file a pro se complaint in an ARDC proceeding, but doesn't open up an envelope for 5 days. Now maybe they didn't consider that. I mean, I considered it because it's in his motion. There are some circumstances here, and then he takes it. He says he wants to go to the Legal Assistance Foundation, and on a matter so critical, he takes some time. I just, before we decide that the BIA had not operated in a correct fashion, I'm just wondering whether that's a hurdle we have to get over before we get to the merits of the 212 issue.
Judge, I think the record at this point is complete, and this court can rule on Mr. Gutierrez's legal claims based on the record.
But what does this decision? Before. What will this decision say to the BIA about their position on denying late filings? Are we just going to say, if you give us one sentence, you're reversed on your discretion that you exercise in that regard? Will this case stand for that? Is I guess what I'm asking.
I think this court should follow its precedent from the cases of Subhan versus Ashcroft, Zali versus Gonzalez, and Benslamani versus Gonzalez, and say that there has to be some sort of meaningful explanation, and that absent that, that
Well, did we remand in that case?
Well, it's important to note that the board based its decision on their conclusion that there was no prejudice. So I think that it would be futile to remand unless this court first says, yes, there was prejudice because the board violated the law of the case doctrine, violated Mr. Gutierrez's equal protection rights, and its decision had an impermissibly retroactive effect. And I see I'm out of time here, Judge, unless you have any further questions.
You have another thought. I don't want to cut you off in the middle of the thought.
Your Honor, I believe our briefs fully cover the equal protection issue. With respect to the retroactivity points, I believe our briefs also fully cover the issue. I would just want to stress again the amount of case law that we cited, both published and unpublished, which shows that the board's analysis up until Blake, allowed people like Mr. Gutierrez to seek a Section 212C waiver. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Reed. I'll permit you some time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Judge.
All right. Ms. Levins.
Good afternoon. Your Honor, I'd first like to just address your questions about the motion to reopen and whether the whether you would need to remand.
Well, we had kind of a sparse ruling by the BIA, didn't we?
Well, I mean, they said his reasons are insufficient, and this court...
That's implicit in just the rejection, right? I mean, does that tell us anything? I mean, obviously, if they reject it, they found it insufficient. I mean, I don't know where that gets us, I guess.
Well, I believe that case law would you have to think that the board considered everything that was before it, just as this court did consider everything before it in the motion to reopen. And certainly the motion to reopen was insufficient in that, you know, he admits that he just didn't do anything for 5 days. And as, you know, as we cited in our brief, the board is not required to cite to every piece in there. They said it's insufficient. That should be enough for this court. However,
the board is essentially saying our reason for refusing to accept your brief is that we don't like your reason for being late. We don't know anything. We don't know if the board read his motion, much less considered his educational background or his language skills. We really, you know, this is not certainly my idea of sufficient. It's very conclusory.
Well, the board, as an appellate body in the immigration context, is presumed to have considered all the evidence before it. We don't presume that they ignore all of that. So presuming that they considered all the evidence before it and did consider his pro se status and all of that, they still found his reasons insufficient, which they certainly were on this record based on his own affidavit that he, you know, knew that that decision was important and still waited 5 days to even approach anyone. However, even if that were even if that the board should have considered that late brief, the board, what they said in their decision on this case was, you know, even if he could have met all of the Lozada requirements, he's simply ineligible for 212C relief. So there would never be any prejudice in an ineffective assistance of counsel claim.
Now, speaking of his ineligibility, alleged ineligibility, on the law of the case argument, it certainly appeared to me that the government was speaking out of both sides of its mouth.
Your Honor,
the government is claiming that Blake was an intervening change in the law. That means the law of the case doctrine shouldn't apply. But at the same time, the government is arguing that Blake was nothing new and that the petitioner never was eligible for 212C relief. Now, it's either one or the other. The government has to pick which one it is. If the law of the case applies, there should be a remand so that an IJ can determine whether he's entitled to 212C relief. I mean, is the petitioner's conviction for criminal sexual abuse of a minor a ground for inadmissibility?
No.
Okay.
No, Your Honor.
Would an alien seeking entry to the United States with this conviction be admissible or not?
Well, there is no ground unless he fell within a specific crime involving moral turpitude.
Specific?
It would depend on whether he fell within 5 to 10 years of admission when he committed the crime involving moral turpitude. However, Congress has specifically chosen, and the Attorney General reiterated this in Hernandez-Castillo, that Congress chose to treat inadmissible aliens differently than deportable aliens, and they hold them to a higher standard of eligibility for 212C relief.
Well, it seems to me that in Valaire, we found that there was no equal protection problem with Section 1212.3F because the very purpose of that provision was to make certain that inadmissible and deportable aliens were treated the same way. If that is not, in fact, what is happening in practice, then it seems to me the petitioner has an as-applied challenge to the regulation.
Your Honor, this is the same case as Valaire. There's no difference in that respect. And in Valaire, this court held that the requirement of the comparable ground of inadmissibility is exactly what would make a removable, non-departing alien like petitioner similarly situated to an inadmissible alien in the first place. And this court recognized that, like the petitioner in Blake, who was found removable for sexual abuse of a minor, in Valeria, the ground was, I believe, indecent assault on a child, but they found that the two were the same. Because there's no substantially equivalent ground of inadmissibility under 212A for either of those offenses, then there can't be an equal protection violation. It is not being applied differently. An inadmissible alien, there's never been a ground. An inadmissible alien has never been inadmissible because of an aggravated felony crime of violence sexual abuse of a minor crime. So there is no waiver for that. If he's inadmissible, there's no waiver for an admissible alien, so there would be no waiver for a deportable alien either.
Let me try and explain my concern.
Yes, Your Honor.
I am concerned that Valaire and Blake allow the government to skirt the intent of 1212.3F by manipulating the charge of deportation so that there is no statutory counterpart of admissibility. In other words, the government here charged Gutierrez Almazan as being deportable because his crime was an aggravated felony, and there is no statutory counterpart for inadmissibility for criminal sexual abuse of a child. That's what I was trying to get to earlier. But you could have charged him under the broad category of crimes of moral turpitude, and then there would be a counterpart for inadmissibility. I mean, is that how this works? The government manipulate the charge in this way to effectively reverse the effect of St. Cyr? And that's what I see happening here, and I am very concerned.
The first thing I would point out is that this court has no jurisdiction over the government's charging decisions, 242G specifically. So I just wanted to point that out.
Believe me. I know that.
I will also point out that every circuit court that has considered this issue of whether we could have charged him with a crime involving moral turpitude has rejected that. The First Circuit in Kim and Fontes, the Second Circuit in Cato, the Third Circuit in Carileo, the Fifth Circuit in Vo, and Avila-Granados. And Avila-Granados actually does discuss sexual abuse of a minor. All of the courts that have looked at whether we could have charged him with a crime involving moral turpitude have specifically rejected that argument, and we would urge this court to reject that argument as well. It's not enough that it could be a crime involving moral turpitude. Certainly many crimes could be charged as crimes involving moral turpitude. there needs to be a textual link between the sexual abuse of a minor charge and the crime involving moral turpitude ground of inadmissibility to indicate that Congress had the same class of offenses in mind. Now, Congress certainly could have chosen to include sexual abuse of a minor as a specific ground of inadmissibility that such that there could be a waiver. They did a lot of amending in 1996, and they specifically chose not to do that. And again, as the Attorney General pointed out in Hernandez-Castillo, when he upheld the comparability test, Congress chose to set the eligibility requirements higher for deportable aliens than those who are inadmissible and returning. So I hope that addresses your concerns, Your Honor, and I would urge this court to follow the other federal circuit courts that have specifically looked at this argument that because he could have possibly been charged with a crime involving moral turpitude, that he should have. The government charged him with what it could charge him at the time. Sexual abuse of a minor was made an aggravated felony in 1996, so that he's charged as an aggravated felon, and there is no ground of inadmissibility for that, and thus he cannot and never could have applied for 212C relief.
You said that the crime, the abuse of the minor, that is a crime of moral turpitude, right? Didn't you say that?
No, Your Honor. I would urge this court not to look at that at this point.
You'd say because it was late filed, we should just look at that, right?
Pardon, Your Honor?
We should take it out because it was late filed and not abuse of discretion. What do you mean we shouldn't look at it?
Well, Your Honor, this court's job is not to determine whether his crime was a crime involving moral turpitude. He wasn't charged with having committed a crime involving moral turpitude.
It doesn't have a comparable...
There's no comparable crime.
Yeah, comparable. I sort of look at it like fruit and an apple, you know? Moral turpitude is much broader, I would assume, encompassing lots of things.
Well, it could. I mean, as the board and Blake recognized that actually sexual abuse of a minor can be broader than a crime involving moral turpitude because a single conviction for sexual abuse of a minor will always be an aggravated felony, while a single crime involving moral turpitude does not necessarily make one inadmissible unless the maximum penalty was greater than 1 year and the sentence was greater than 6 months. So the board did discuss that in Blake.
All right. Well,
and I can understand your concerns. However, the issue before this court is not whether this is a crime involving moral turpitude. That if he had been charged with a crime involving moral turpitude, then the issue would be whether the offense, sexual abuse of a minor, was in fact a crime involving moral turpitude. But to do that, this court would have to get into the actual facts of the conviction. And
it's not comparable as written.
It's not comparable as written, Your Honor. If I realize I'm out of time, if I could briefly just address the law of the case argument. Our first position is that there is no law of the case. The board simply remanded under St. Cyr. They never looked specifically at eligibility. They did that with a lot of cases. The board at the time needed to be allowed to manage its own docket, and given the length of time that the St. Cyr cases were pending and the sheer numbers, the board's decision was just to start remanding them back, saying, oh, it looks like they're eligible for 212C. Let's let the immigration judges sort it out. So it was really a docket managing system that was going on then.
So that's how we get...
Well, Your Honor,
that's how we get past all this. There's no law of the case.
Well, there is no law of the case because law of the case necessarily requires an adjudication, and they didn't adjudicate the 212C application. Law of the case is based on public policy that litigation needs to come to an end, and therefore it requires some sort of adjudication. So we would argue that there was no adjudication. It was basically the board.
So it doesn't matter that the government says he was never eligible for 212C relief? I'm a little mixed up now.
I'm not sure I understand that, Your Honor. Well, he's never eligible for 212C relief. The board didn't look at the comparability test. They didn't look at any of that when they remanded under St. Cyr. They just noted they had hundreds of cases that St. Cyr potentially affected, and they just remanded them back to immigration judges to let them determine eligibility.
See, that's the way I think the government is getting around needing to pick one, one way or the other,
Your Honor,
by saying that, There is no law of the case here.
You did have some concerns with trying to argue, I guess, out of both sides of our mouths that this is...
Yes.
Is, and I think the court did address that to some extent in Valare when the law, the comparability test is an old test. It dates back to the 1970s, certainly much longer than longer ago than petitioner pled guilty. However, the sexual abuse of a minor issue, when the board applied it, is new. They didn't apply it to sexual abuse of a minor until Blake. One could presume that if petitioner's attorney had, in fact, filed his 212C application on time, that petitioner would have been Blake, and that would have been the first case where the board applied the comparability test to sexual abuse of a minor crime. So it is an old comparability test is old, but the application to the crime of sexual abuse of a minor is new in that respect. However, even if this court believes that the law of the case argument does apply, the government would argue that Blake constituted a change in the law such that the old decision, that the board's decision, no longer applied. It could also be argued that if the court isn't going to buy that one, that the decision, that April 2002 decision of the board was clearly erroneous because under the comparability test, he was never eligible for 212C. So you have several grounds in which you can say the law of the case argument will go away, that there was no law of the case that applied in this case.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Levins.
Here.
Thank you.
You may have your full 3 minutes.
Oh, thank you, Judge. I don't think it'll take that long. Counsel mentioned that the board actually made no decision in Mr. Gutierrez's case as to whether or not he was eligible. I just want to read briefly from their decision. I would quote, because the respondent would have been eligible for a Section 212C waiver under the law in effect at the time of his plea, we will remand the record to the immigration court to afford the respondent an opportunity to apply for such a waiver. Also, if you look at the record before the immigration judge, he was quite clear that Mr. Gutierrez could have had his hearing but for his attorney's errors. Furthermore, I also want to correct something I said earlier. Mr. Gutierrez's attorney wasn't just disciplined. He was actually suspended for 2 years for his conduct in other cases, other immigration matters. With respect to the issue of whether Mr. Gutierrez would have been inadmissible for a crime involving moral turpitude and whether that's a comparable ground, I just want to emphasize that he would have been inadmissible. I don't think there can be any argument that he wouldn't have been inadmissible for having committed a crime involving moral turpitude. There's a plethora of case law saying that sexual abuse of a minor is a crime involving moral turpitude. He was sentenced, he was convicted of a felony, and therefore he would have fit under the inadmissibility provision. And with respect to whether this court should follow the other circuits, I just want to mention that it appears that there has been a decision issued today from the Second Circuit on this issue, which we intend to raise in a 28-J letter to this court, right, which is directly on point on that issue. Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Our thanks to all counsel, and the case is taken under